Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it is another special. Today we're having a conversation with Dr. Rangan Chatterjee. You would know him. He's the fella off telly. He's in that show, Doctor in the House, where he went and lived with people and tried to explain to them how to live their lives better and get healthier. He's also published a couple of books, The Four-Pillar Plan, which was to try and... I think in America, this is interesting. I found this on Wikipedia. They changed... It was called The Four-Pillar Plan over here. In America, they changed it to How to Make Disease Disappear. And then he's got a new book out called The Stress Solution. Interesting man.
That sounds like one of our old podcast titles when we used to claim absurd things.
I think fascinating about him is he's a working GP. He was, and he still keeps his hand in.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing. And so he knows a lot. We have a fascinating conversation all about health, but also the stuff to do with the NHS, which I think is really good.
Interesting.
And sort of solutions for the NHS. As we all know, the NHS is a wonderful organization.
Yeah. He obviously really cares.
Yeah.
About what he does, both on a sort of, I hate the phrase macro, I don't know why, but that, you know, the macro thing of NHS and, you know, doctors and stuff, but also specifically about his patients. He really cares and finds patient specific stuff to do with them, which he showed us a couple, which are really, really helpful actually.
Yeah. All right, let's meet him. He's Rangan.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to my kitchen, Rangan. Thank you for coming today. I've, like with all the guests, I bought you a present. But I bought you alcohol, and I don't know whether you drink, but it's a good way of starting a conversation. Do you drink?
I do, yeah, fantastic.
Okay, well, I bought you a bottle of a nice bottle of red wine.
Thank you very much indeed.
So before we get stuck into your books and stuff, how is our relationship with alcohol in this country? We seem to drink quite a lot.
Yeah, we do. And it's funny, really. I think our relationship with alcohol... it's something that's almost embedded into us from like a young age. So, you know, I remember at school, you know, even from 14, 15, a big part of what is done on Saturdays revolves around going drinking. I think, you know, I grew up in an Indian family where sort of, you know, my dad would have like a couple of beers maybe on a Friday night while he was doing the ironing. I remember that really well. But it wasn't a big part of my life growing up. So I think when I got to uni, like many other people, you go a bit crazy, you go a bit nuts with it. And do you know what? I've been thinking a lot about alcohol recently, and I think what it is that I think a lot of the time people are trying to cut down, but they can't because they're not dealing with the underlying reason why they're drinking in the first place. Sure, drinking can be fun, but if you're using it because you're super stressed, then I kind of think that, you know, that one glass can easily turn into a couple of bottles of wine.
Or they're bored. I often think people use food as entertainment and alcohol as entertainment. Yeah. They're sitting at home and they're thinking, I'm a bit bored, so I'll have a drink or eat a pint of ice cream or something. And they're the stuff that's not good for you. We had a sleep expert on here called Dr. Mir Krieger, and he said, he was talking about alcohol and saying how bad it is for your sleep. He said, alcohol's fine, but treat it like caffeine. Don't do it at night. He was basically saying all day drinking's fine, but
exactly. Well, you know what? It's funny you say that because I realized this from a personal perspective a few years ago. I used to do a lot of skiing in Chamonix. I've got a band out there, so we play a lot of music. And I remember that if you were playing late and you were sort of having some alcoholic drinks late, you wouldn't sleep very well. And I realized that actually, if you do it earlier at pro ski, you know, you have a couple of beers, let's say, or a couple of glasses of wine, that actually it doesn't seem to affect your sleep at night. Now, there's a lot of science now that's actually supporting why that might be. But yeah, it certainly fits for sure.
What did you do in the band?
I was a singer and guitar player, yeah.
Yes, what sort of music?
So out in Chamonix, there's a lot of covers. And, you know, people are out on a ski holiday. They want to party and have fun. So, you know, Prince, Rolling Stones, Maroon 5, U2, whatever, basically.
Did you do his high notes, Prince's high notes?
We dropped the key of the song so that I could try and have a go at it. So I did, but I was cheating, basically.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I was reading your website earlier, and it says, my mission is to help 100 million people feel fantastic by restoring them to optimal health. That's quite a big ask.
It's a big ask. And I think as someone who grew up in the UK, it's something that initially, before I put it on my website, I felt very uncomfortable about doing it. Because, you know, as Brits, we're sort of, that's not the sort of thing we really say. You know, we're very sort of, how could I put it? We're just a little bit understated in how we say things, and we don't like to say things like that. I'll tell you what happened there. So, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, I've been doing quite a bit in the media, starting off with my sort of BBC One shows called Doctor in the House, where I sort of went into families' houses, people who'd been sick for about, you know, for years, already been under GPs, or many of them already under specialists, many of them on medication. And, you know, in pretty much all the cases, I'm very lucky to have been able to get them significantly better within about 6 weeks by addressing their lifestyle. And I realized that, you know, about 5 million people watched each show in the UK. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, if 1% of people make a change in their lifestyle based upon what they've just seen, you know, that's what, about 50,000 people you may have had the opportunity to impact. And then I thought, well, it could be less than 1%. It could be more than 1%. What if it's 10%? That could be 500,000 people who are starting to make positive lifestyle changes based on something that they've seen. And there was a Guardian article about a year ago saying there's 100 million people in the world have to choose between medical care and food. And I was really struck by it when I read it. I just thought, that's an incredible figure of people. And I just thought about what I've been doing the last years. And I thought, actually, you know what? Is it possible to impact the health of that many people? I thought, I don't know if it's possible, but that's certainly my aim. And it's funny, a few people have picked up on that and said, actually, that's a mission I can get behind. And I've learned that by putting it out there, you know, whether it's the podcast that I do, whether it's the books, the TV, or just seeing patients in my practice, I find that the bulk of what I'm doing with all of them is not dissimilar. So I think if I can actually preach this message or spread this message to as many people as possible, then I think it's absolutely possible. But yeah, is it a big ask? Sure, it is.
Do you feel that one of the big problems then is food?
I think food is a big problem, but I don't think it's everything. And I think far too much is put onto food.
It's a worldwide global crisis about to happen, isn't it? I watched a documentary once on the French fry, because only it's been great for breaking down borders, you know, sort of McDonald's and stuff, Eastern Bloc. Apparently the children desperately wanted McDonald's. And so it's one of the great factors for breaking down the sort of Eastern Bloc countries, getting them more democratic. But also in Africa and Asia, the local cuisines have been taken over by fried potato. Yeah. And the kids would rather have that. And we've seen massive obesity all around the world because of Western-style fast food.
Yeah, there's no question food's a massive factor. But honestly, Tim, if we were doing this conversation 5 years ago and you said to me, what's the biggest lifestyle factor that affects your patients? I would have said food. But I genuinely have changed my mind. I've evolved my thinking. And if you ask me that question now, I'd say, actually, I think it's stress. And the reason I say that is because, yes, food is a big factor in, you know, our weight, the way we feel, even our moods. No question. And I'm always an advocate for people trying to eat healthier and change their nutrition. But often I find that the reason people can't quit, let's say, the sugar or the crisps in the evening, you know, at this time of year when it's dark and, you know, you've got the lights on and you just got telly on, you know, oh, I fancy something sweet. I often find the reason why people can't quit the sugar or even the booze, let's say, if they're drinking too much,
yeah,
is because they're stressed. Life is so stressful now that a bit of sugar helps relieve that stress in the short term.
Yeah.
A bit of booze helps relieve that in the short term. So I think we're not dealing with the underlying cause
right,
some of the time.
Okay, we're going to talk about your book, The Stress Solution, in just a minute. I just want to get a tiny bit of background on you first, though, because the way you changed your views started when your son got rickets. Is that true?
Yeah, I think, you know, that
so
was...
You're a jobbing GP, is that right?
Jobbing GP,
yeah.
Doing my job. I'd been working, what was that? When did that happen? That happened in 2010. So I qualified in August 2001. So I'd been working as a doctor for 9 years. Now, the first 6 or 7 years was in hospitals. I was doing my specialist exam. I was going to be a kidney specialist. I moved to general practice, actually, because I felt that we were getting too specialized in medicine. And again, look, I think specialism is important, but I didn't want to spend my whole career just seeing kidney problems.
What does that mean, we're getting too specialized?
What I mean by that is that we've become so reductionist with how we look at the body that we're, you know, it's not uncommon now that you have a situation like this in general practice where someone comes in, or someone's been to A&E at the weekend with chest pain, right? Mm-hmm. And A&E rule out your heart. So they say, hey, look, you know, I know you've got chest pain, you come and say, it's not your heart, go back and see a GP, okay? So they've said it's not your heart. And sometimes then we might refer to a respiratory doctor to look at the chest, and they might look at the patient and go, look, it's not your heart, I don't think this is a lung problem, you might want to go and see a gastroenterologist. And then you get back to your GP and you get sent to someone else, say, oh, could this be a gastro problem that's showing up in the chest? That may sound like an extreme example, but it's not uncommon that this sort of thing happens these days, where we're so sort of siloed in our compartments of the body, we've forgotten a little bit that the body is interconnected and one thing affects something else. And so for me, for me personally, I think I want to see everything. I want to see how different parts of the body interact with each other. So I'm going to go to general practice. I can tell you, you know, I remember telling my dad that, who was a consultant at Manchester Royal Infirmary. He was so confused why his son would leave the hallowed turf of specialism to move to general practice. But it's something I really wanted to do.
So is specialism regarded higher than GP?
You know, look, my dad's an Indian immigrant here from Calcutta. He came here in the early 60s when the UK was recruiting a lot of doctors from India to help fill the gaps here. I think in my dad's eyes and a lot of Indian immigrant doctors' eyes, yeah, the goal was to be a specialist. And if you couldn't do that back then, often you would end up as a GP. And that certainly, I think, was his perception, a lot of his colleagues. I think that has changed a little bit, but in some places that still exists.
I've always wondered when we recruit people from Calcutta. Obviously, your dad thinks, I'm going over to Britain. Probably the facilities are better. I get to learn more and do more exciting things. But does that leave a huge hole in Calcutta?
I think that, you know, that this is something, Tim, I think over the last few years, I've become a little bit more aware of. You know, I think I took this stuff for granted growing up. But I've been thinking, you know, is it ethically okay on one level, right, to recruit doctors quite aggressively from another part of the world, uh-huh, when they've already been trained up by those systems to help fill our gaps? And I get why we've done it. And, you know, of course, my dad came also over because he thought there's the promise of a better life. And he's going to be able to, you know, I remember my dad in the few years before he died, I remember him saying to me, you know, if I'd stayed at home in India, I don't think I'd ever be able to have this much autonomy in my job and be able to buy my own house. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. You know, I've grown up here sort of knowing that that is an achievable aim for many of us. Certainly, I've had a fortunate upbringing. My dad was medical, so I went to a decent school, and therefore, I think I had lots of good opportunities in life, which I've realized the more time you spend with people, the more you realize not everyone has those opportunities. So I think it is a little bit unfair, society, in terms of how that plays out. But yeah, I think, Tim, you make a really good point, which is it the right thing to do to be recruiting other healthcare professionals from other countries? And we're doing that now with nurses.
Yeah, well, I always find it weird with anything like Brexit or anything like that, when people sit there and go, well, where's all the people who are going to take up all the jobs? The NHS is run by all the foreigners. Like, we're sitting here looking around for, I can't think of a proper word to use without sounding horrific. But we're sitting around and thinking, where are the low workers from other nations? Rather than us actually addressing the problem, which is maybe we need to change the job to make it more attractive, change the pay scheme to make it more attractive, we're going, no, let's get cheap labour in from other countries and steal their nurses. That's what it sometimes feels a bit like that to me. But I don't know. I'm not knowledgeable about
this. Yeah, Tim, look, I can't say I've got intimate knowledge of how the health service recruits from other countries.
Yeah.
But I think on a 30,000 foot view level, I think we do have to ask ourselves these questions. Is, yes, we've got a shortage of doctors and nurses. We're struggling with appointment times. The NHS is under a lot of pressure. How are we going to fill the gaps? Oh, I know. Let's go and get people from other countries who can also do that job. That may be solving or going part of the way to solving our problems. But what's it leaving behind?
That's exactly what I always think.
And I think we have to start, you know, there's so much turmoil now in the world. You know, when you talk about Brexit, when you talk about Trump and America, whatever it is. And I think, you know, I don't know if it's, you know, since I became a dad, I think I've started to look at the world in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure we can really have all these tight borders and actually just go, well, as long as we're okay, that's okay. You know, we all share one world. The world's resources have been depleted. On one level, we all kind of have to try and help there be harmony throughout the world. I mean, this is getting quite political now, but
yeah, but I imagine
it's a good point.
I imagine in the people who come over, though, especially if they're up to the quality of your father or something, they'll think, I'm going to use better machines, I'm going to have better medication, yeah. I can actually really fulfill my potential here. So it's a great job for someone coming
exactly.
over.
Exactly. And so, yeah. you know, also there yeah. also, you know, my dad left his family, left his country to come here for a better yeah. life. So it works both ways. But then, you know, look at this country, look at our taxi drivers, right? Okay, I think, you know, we must have some of the most highly qualified cab drivers in the world, because sometimes I get picked up and I take a cab and you talk to people. I love chatting to cab drivers and finding out where they're from and what they're doing. You know, I've spoken to like accountants.
Are you talking about black cabs or Ubers or both?
Any,
okay.
Any. I'm just saying that, you know, often you see people who've come into this country and they used to be like an accountant.
Right.
But the only work they can get is to drive a cab. So they're sort of cracking yeah. on driving a cab. I met a pharmacist the other day. He was a pharmacist in India, or was it Pakistan? I can't remember. And he now drives a cab because that's his way of earning a living. Someone was an engineer the other day I met. And I, you know, on one level, I find that incredible that some people coming over here, they're that dedicated to wanting to give their families a better life, that they'll do whatever it takes. You know, if that's driving a taxi, they'll drive a taxi. If they can get the profession that they've been trained in, brilliant. But for many of them, they can't do that. And I find that super interesting.
We don't want to get too political here, but you're working in the NHS now? Have you given it up? Your job?
No, still working in the NHS.
You're still doing it?
So, yeah.
So you still got to practice?
Well, I'm currently locuming.
Right.
So
what does that mean?
Until about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I had a practice, regular mm-hmm. practice. I used to be a partner in a place called Timperley in the Northwest. I was working in a practice.
Isn't that where Frank Sidebottom's from?
Frank Sidebottom, yeah, he might be. You know what?
Mark? Do you know? Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, and I also worked in a practice as a salary GP in Oldham for 7 years. And Oldham is, you know, the practice I worked in was a very deprived practice. We had a deprived area, I should say. Lots yep. of patients who were on social security, lots of patients with pretty challenging life circumstances. And I, you know, it was a real contrast from Simply, and I really got to see two opposite ends of the spectrum of sort of affluent middle class general practice and, you know, more deprived areas. And yeah. I learned so much. There's a lot of common themes there. But I realized basically that, you know, when I first started doing the work on telly, which I think I started filming the first series of Doctor in the House in the end of 2014, mm-hmm. I kept my NHS work going whilst I was doing all of that.
Right.
And it was pretty tricky. It was pretty intense and I managed to do it. But when the second series came around, I thought this is a little bit unfair on my practice. And I really had to ask myself those questions. What do I want? And I figured out that because the first series had been such a big success and I managed to help show things like reversal of type 2 diabetes, for example, in about 30 yeah. days, you know, stuff that I'm really proud of. I thought, actually, you know what? I'd love to do another series, really take on some more complex and challenging problems. I don't think I can also give my best to my practice whilst I'm doing that. So I thought, okay, I'm still going to work
yeah.
as an NHS GP. I'm going to locum now. So I locum in different practices around my media work.
And what does that mean? You just
you go
fill
so
in.
I've got a few practices who basically use me. And they'll tell you when there's some shifts available and you'll book them in.
Okay.
Because
Keep your hand in.
But more than that, I don't ever really want to stop seeing patients because I love it.
But it's so hard. I turn up and I've got, which I did not so long ago, a lump in my groin. It turned out it was just an inflamed gland.
Yeah.
But then they had to send me away because they wanted to make sure it wasn't cancerous because it was a lump and everything else. So I had an ultrasound and blood tests and things like that. But then someone else will come in with a throat thing and someone else will come in with a bad knee and then you'll have depression and stress and everything. How, as a doctor, are you supposed to know everything?
Well, you know, there's so many points there, Tim. I mean, on one level, general practice, you know, we are, you know, expert generalists. So that's really our speciality in some ways, is to have that broad understanding of everything. And when necessary, we can refer for specialist expertise in a particular area. But I do think we've overly focused on the specialism in general. Even within the profession, I won't say we've overvalued specialists. I think we've undervalued generalists.
Yeah, but isn't that because people are scared of getting sued?
Absolutely.
My brother sadly died of pancreatic cancer. When he went to his GP and when he went to a lot of people, they said, you've got irritable bowel syndrome. When my brother eventually died, pancreatic cancer is a killer, as you know. Yeah. It's very hard to heal. And he was a young man to get it. So many people said, are you going to sue? And my parents and myself are going, no. They're like, no one meant to kill my brother. You know, he had something, it was unusual for, he was only 37, unusual thing. But that culture of, no, someone made a mistake because they didn't get to it early. Even if they had got it early, as you know, with pancreatic cancer, by the time the signs come.
Yeah, it's pretty late.
It's going to be terminal. So it's not good. But that whole attitude of people go, what are you going to do about it? Someone's going to be blamed. It's quite tough on the medical profession isn't it?
I mean, first of all, so I'm really sorry to hear about your brother.
Fine. Well, it's not fine, but it is what it is. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the defensive practice of medicine is one of the big problems of today, in the sense that, you know, often our first thought is, not our first thought, but often right at the forefront of our thoughts is, when a patient comes in, is, how do I make sure I don't get sued?
Wow. Right?
And I talk to doctors about this, and it's very commonly known. It's called defensive medicine. So if someone comes in with, let's say, a stomach complaint,
yeah,
right? Yes, we're thinking about what is causing it. But at some point in that consultation, even if it's a compressed 10-minute or even a 7-minute consultation, we will also make sure we ask what are called red flag questions to make sure that we can justify in our notes, if something happens later, that we had thought, could this be cancer? Could this be something else? And so a big part of what we'll do is, first of all, is make sure we've got the information we need to document in the notes. Because again, if you don't document it and someone sues you later, in the eyes of the law, it didn't happen. So if we don't document those important things, and again, that brings the whole paperwork aspect to it. So it's not 10 minutes seeing a patient. It's 10 minutes to see the patient, figure out what's going on, ask the red flag questions, hopefully give them some treatment that's going to help, and also write up notes so that if you do get sued, you're not going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
And doctors, I don't know what the current stat is, Tim, but a few years ago it was, we're going to get sued, I think, at least 2 to 3 times in our career.
That is horrific.
On average.
That's terrible, because you're going to your job to try and help people.
It's killer, I know.
And you didn't mean to make a mistake. Yeah,
exactly.
Or not see the signs.
A really good friend of mine, she nearly quit medicine over this, because there was a complaint made. It was a year of haggling and answering letters to the solicitor and all kinds of things. And literally 2 weeks before it was going to go to court. It got thrown out because there was no case there. But in that 1 year, the torment, and she's like, oh my God, all I'm trying to do is just help. I don't think I've done anything wrong. But yeah. I'm having to go and have these meetings with the defense union. And this is also playing into the frustration in the medical profession, the frustration with the public as well, that they can't get appointments. And on that, about not getting appointments, you've got a big problem here where GPs are overworked and overstressed.
Mm-hmm.
So most GPs I know are, are contemplating, how do I get out of this? Because, you know, they love seeing the patients, but the workload is impacting their personal health, their marriages, the time they can get with their kids. And, you know, patients are understandably frustrated they can't get appointments in some practices. Yet a lot of doctors are seeing 50 to 60 patients a day. They can't physically see anymore.
50 to 60?
Yeah. So there's a mismatch. There's a mismatch, right?
And I suppose what happens is someone like me comes in with a lump. They go, don't take a risk, which is the problem. Let's send him to a...
Exactly.
And so they send me off to get an ultrasound. Pretty much I knew and he knew I'd been run down.
But it means no one can sue later.
But that means I'm not going to sue him later. And he knows that I've got someone who died of cancer in my family. So it's a bit quite raw with me. So he says, oh, just go off and do that. And then it puts more pressure on the NHS. Yeah, I mean,
there's so many factors. There's no quick fix solution to this.
But one of the solutions is, is there anything you would do in the NHS which is different?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think one thing I say, I think the age of the 10-minute consultation is over, or it should be over. I think for the complexity of problems we now are seeing in general practice, I just don't think 10 minutes is enough. I think it's barely enough time to say hello, get to know someone, you know, without all the other things you have to do. So that's one thing I would like to change. And one way we could do that potentially is... you could split even general practice appointments up into acute and chronic. So you could even potentially go down to 5 minutes for some acute problems, like, you know, I don't know, ear infections or things that are getting, you know, we can quickly assess, diagnose and give a treatment for. And then maybe we could, that could free up time to have 20-minute appointments for more long-term and chronic conditions. I think that's something we might need to explore. That's one thing. I think we need to embrace group consultations more. That's a model that's been used in America. So what does that mean? That would mean that if I am seeing 10 patients with type 2 diabetes, right, by and large, about 75-80% of what I'm saying to them is very similar. Sure, there's going to be individual... There's going to be some sort of personalization depending if people are on medication, if they're having side effects. You know. Of course, there are some differences. And I actually did this in Oldham when in my practice. This was a few years ago. I couldn't, unfortunately, I wasn't able to persuade the people who I needed to persuade to make this a long-term thing. But I thought, okay, this is ridiculous. For 10 people, I'm seeing them for 10 minutes of time. So what's that? That's an hour and 40 minutes of consultation time for these 10 different patients. I thought, well, what happens if I get in 10 or 15 patients into like the seminar room in the practice and actually give them a chat, give them a bit of a educational talk on type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And I did that and they loved it. So I told them the same stuff, drew them all the blood sugar graphs, explained what the condition is and how different lifestyle factors affect it. And then what you also do by doing that is that then you've got a certain magic, which is that power of community.
Yes, definitely.
Because in NHS general practice, we still have practice boundaries, right?
Yeah.
So these guys all lived pretty close to each other. So they can give each other support.
Yeah.
And I thought this would be something that I know I saw a press article about this, I think, you know, just 2 or 3 months ago. So it's something that we are, you know, the authorities are now looking at. I think that is something we should consider.
Well, one of the big things about getting a disease of any description is you feel very alone because you think you're the only one with it. And then when you put, like, I was talking about this the other day with my brother when he got cancer. He felt very alone. When he went to meet some other people who had cancer, suddenly it's like, oh, there's more of us than just one. It helps massively. So that must be the same with diabetes, where you can go, what are you doing about it? What are you doing? How are you doing it?
And of course, you might need extra appointments to personalize medications and all those sort of things. You know, for people who are listening or watching, you know, I get that. It's not about breaking confidentiality. People can voluntarily come. If they don't feel comfortable, they don't need to come. But I think that's one idea. Just on your point about community, it reminds me of what happens a lot. You know, one of the problems I'm seeing a lot now is a lack of libido. And even in like people in their 20s and 30s, it's a huge issue. And when guys like 21, 22 are coming in telling me that they're having problems either with sex drive or with an ability, you know, to function.
Yeah.
One of the things they really makes them feel good is when you say, hey, you know what? I'm seeing this every day. There's so many young guys like you who are coming in. And you know, obviously there are many reasons for it, but it's really interesting just for them knowing that there's other guys out there who are suffering it.
What are the reasons?
Suddenly, there are so many reasons. But
online,
you know, honestly,
porn.
Pardon?
Online porn.
Yeah, I'm sure that is contributing, no question. But I think if I'm honest, it's the biggest factor I see is stress.
Right.
It genuinely is. And there's a couple of reasons for that. But the point of it, of the story really is that community, anytime we know we're not the only one, I think that makes us feel good.
We should get stressed, but just prior to doing that, we didn't finish the rickets story. So you were a general practitioner and your son turned out to have rickets.
Yeah. So basically this is a pretty huge turning point in my life. First child, my wife had been breastfeeding for 6 months and then we went on holiday to France just after Christmas. And, you know, basically we got there and I just remember my wife didn't want to put him to sleep because she just felt, you know, we thought he had a cold. He was finding it difficult to breathe. He had a lot of mucus that day. It was a bit unusual for him, but you know, mother's instinct, for some reason, she didn't put him downstairs in the cot. And so she was just sitting there with him on the sofa in a friend's house we were staying at. And I was just in the kitchen. Suddenly she calls out to me because basically, he stopped moving. His arms went back. He went rigid and he just stopped and he froze. And she called out to me. I ran over. I thought he might be choking on mucus. You know, in that moment, you know, I was a highly qualified doctor, but frankly, I was just a worried dad. You know, I couldn't really think clearly. I just thought he was choking. So I turned him over. I tried to slap him, tried to clear his airway. nothing was happening. And in a nutshell, I sort of froze. I wasn't quite sure what was going on. And my wife said, come on, you know, we've just got to get into A&E now. So we run into the car. I nearly kill us all driving there because it had just snowed heavily. And I nearly turned the car over. And we got there. And, you know, modern medicine's great. Ultimately, they saved his life because, you know, he'd had a convulsion. He had to be blue lighted down the mountain into a sort of bigger hospital where they could assess him properly. He had two lumbar punctures that night. We weren't sure if he was going to make it through the night. It was a super scary time. And I remember that it must have been late that night or maybe around midnight that the French doctors came and said, the first thing they said is that we know why he's had a convulsion now. Because they thought it might be meningitis. They were doing all sorts of tests to figure out what had happened. And said he's got really low calcium level. So his it's what we call a hypocalcemic convulsion. So his calcium level was so low that he had a convulsion. And the question is, why is his calcium so low? And then about an hour later, another blood test came back, which was his vitamin D level. And they said he's got no vitamin D in his system. He's had a vitamin D deficiency, which is why his calcium has dropped so low. And there's so much more to that story. But in a nutshell, it was like, well, hold on a minute. How could it be that this is a fully preventable vitamin deficiency? I used to be a specialist. I've got an immunology degree. I'm used to general practice. I thought, how with all my qualifications is my son nearly dying from a preventable vitamin deficiency? And yes, we found out then he had rickets, you know, a Victorian illness that actually is on the rise in the UK. And that's another big thing for me. I'm really trying to raise awareness that it is on the rise and it's fully preventable, which is, I think, a scandalous. And the key thing here, Tim, is that he had a calcium infusion into his blood to save him, right? That's what modern medicine is brilliant at. But then no one there would tell me, well, what are the implications of potentially for 6 months, potentially in utero, he didn't have a critical nutrient potentially that is necessary for his immune system to develop. And I became obsessed. I thought, okay, right, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to try and I would literally become obsessed 3-4 hours a day. I'd be reading about this vitamin D, about the immune system. And the more I learned, the more I thought, wait a minute, there's a whole ton of science out here that I don't know as a doctor that I think is going to be really helpful, not only for my son, but also my patients. And I just went on a journey. The more I learned, the more I started applying with him. You know, I had one goal in mind, which was to get him back to full health as if this had never happened. It was almost like an obsession for me. Because I felt I felt really guilty that I in some way had allowed this to happen. And weirdly enough, and this is something I really haven't spoken about much, but 2 weeks before that happened, I had been reading a few things about vitamin D and I thought, oh, I wonder if my son should actually be on vitamin D. And I phoned my wife from work. I was in Oldham at the time. I phoned her and said, hey, look, babe, you know, I reckon he probably should be on vitamin D, but we get told by the GMC, the General Medical Council, that we shouldn't really be making decisions on our family or our friends. That's deemed not good medical practice. So I sent her the protocol that I'd seen. I said, hey, could you just go and see your GP and take it in? And she went to see the GP with it and said, look, my husband's a GP. He just thinks that our son should be on vitamin D drops. This is the protocol that he's sent. And the GP said to my wife, look, this is complete nonsense. He doesn't need anything. You know, if you have a good diet, you breastfeed, you don't need to do anything. You could have actually just printed this off on Word and done it yourself. I've got no, you know, there's no way that I know that that's true. I haven't seen anything like this.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later, he's, you know, barely alive in a French hospital. So, I mean, that's a slight, I mean, I'm not sure how relevant that is, but I think I wished on so many levels that I'd actually set, I just put my foot down.
So it changed the way you viewed medicine.
Changed the way I viewed medicine completely.
Just quickly, does the NHS, someone told me once there's a real lag time in the NHS, which means, someone told me it was 20 years. Is that true? Where new medicine happens or new thought processes happen, and the NHS gets them 20 years later because it takes so long to get through.
Yeah, there's basically this whole theme, which is from new research to become mainstream medical practice, depending on what study you read, it takes in the region of 20 to 30 years.
Right, okay.
Right, so it takes a long time. And obviously when it's your own son, you're like, well, hold on a minute. I am waiting 20, 30 years. And, you know, little things like he had really bad eczema.
Right.
I thought, well, hold on a minute. Eczema is in part a dysfunction of the immune system. So vitamin D is a critical nutrient for the immune system. Could this be why he's got such bad eczema? Weirdly enough, as we corrected it, as I did all the sort of things I learned with him, he's got no eczema most of the time now.
Okay.
And you know, I started applying those principles with him, with me, with my family. We all start feeling great. And, you know, it also feeds in a little bit, Tim, to your question about 10, 15 minutes ago, which was, what would you do differently in the NHS? I think the only way we save the NHS, really, is to start taking the weight of lifestyle-driven illness off it, because I don't think it can cope. And I don't just mean type 2 diabetes and obesity. Even, you know, mental health problems now, 1 in 4 people, right, in the UK, in any given year, are going to suffer from a mental health problem. That's a staggering statistic. Now, there are many factors that contribute, but our lifestyles are part of the problem. Mm. And, you know, we are very much trained in pharmaceutical solutions to problems that worked beautifully well 20, 30 years ago when people were coming in with acute problems like, you know, you had a pneumonia. You know what? We'll give you an antibiotic that will kill the bug. And then a week or two later, you no longer have that problem. You know, acute problems work very well with our sort of one pill for every ill model. But when people are coming in with chronic problems that have got multiple factors driving them, a lot of them being our collective modern lifestyles, that I don't think the model of care that we have, even the framework in which general practice has built up here with these 10-minute appointments, I don't think it lends itself to really helping people make behavior change in their lifestyles, which ultimately I think is what's needed.
Yeah, but the general public are frustrating, aren't they? Because they just hear the news but don't make the changes. So,
but it's, I think it's too hard to make the changes for so many of us.
Well, I don't know, that everything in moderation expression just annoys the hell out of me. Right, I'm going to eat takeaway 3 times a week. Someone will say it's everything in moderation. It's like, no, that's not moderation. That's ridiculous. You're eating far too much takeaway. Something like that. Or I tell you one, which is a very good example, is because I did a bit of work with skin cancer and Factor 50, it was called this. The stats are, you could tell me this if it's still happening, the stats of skin cancer are still on the rise. And yet you tell to people, make sure you wear sunscreen. And what I struggled with was everybody's attitude towards it, was they were doing things like, what was it called? Fake it, don't bake it, and stuff like that. And I was sort of saying to people, is that really the right message? Isn't the message, be happy with the color you are? Stop talking about sodding healthy tans and stuff, and actually tell the truth that that's your pigment all swelling up and it's not actually fantastic for you if you do it too much, you know? But people go, nah, it's healthy for you to go and lie in the sun for 2 weeks and for 6 hours
hey,
a day.
We can all, and myself included, tell ourselves a narrative that we like because it helps us engage in the behaviors that maybe we're used to, the habits we're used to. So I get that. I think that's part of the human condition to a certain degree. But I think you bring a really interesting point, which is there's information and then there's action. But there's this gray space in between, isn't there? You know, when we know, let's say, you know, you ask any smoker knows that smoking is bad for them. You know, telling them that actually smoking is going to give you lung cancer, I'm not convinced it. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, they sort of know that, yet often it doesn't lead to action. So I'm really think a lot about what sits in that space between knowledge and action. And it's really tricky.
So I can't act as a saint. I was there. I used to smoke a lot. I gave up 17 years ago, but I used to smoke a lot.
Why did you give up?
Because I just used to sit there beating myself. Actually, there's very different reasons, but a couple of people said to me, you don't look like a smoker. And I was like, I'm not a smoker. What? This is ridiculous. How did I become a smoker?
Yeah, exactly.
Was one of the things. Then I've got this way of giving up smoking, which if you never put another cigarette in your mouth, you'll never smoke again, which I do on the podcast. People laugh about. But I just thought, I don't want to be a smoker and it's going to kill me. And I used to sit there thinking about it a lot. So I decided to give it up because it was just a stupid idea. But it was tough to do.
Yeah.
I always say it was the hardest thing I did, but also the easiest thing you do. You just don't smoke again.
For whatever reason, in that moment, you had motivation, didn't you? Something had happened that had connected with you that you thought, hey, I'm not a smoker. Well, you know, hold on, what do you mean calling me a smoker? Yeah, I smoke a few cigarettes, but I'm not a smoker.
Yeah.
And you made that change. Whereas I kind of feel, is this the human condition that things have to get bad enough on one level for us to go, actually, I need to make a change now.
Yeah.
You know, the classic case of someone who has a heart attack and survives and gets, and suddenly then will change all their unhealthy habits that we knew for 20 years. Even though they knew they were unhealthy for 20 years, now they've suddenly got the motivation. But I also think there are things like we make it too hard. So let's say working out, for example, right? Everyone sort of knows we should be a bit more physically active. I think we neglect strength training, right? So I've got a little story here, which I think is quite interesting. So once we hit the age of 30, we start to lose muscle mass each year. Okay. And, you know, both of us are, you know, just over the age of 30, I can see. And basically, I remember a few years ago in practice, I told this guy, I think it was a fireman, he came in to see me, and I was telling him the new science on strength training and say, how, look, I really think this is impacting you. And we know that your lean muscle mass is probably the biggest factor to determine how well you're going to be when you age. So it's really important. Yeah, when we think about working out, we're often not thinking about muscle. You know, we associate muscle with like teenagers, people in their 20s trying to look buff. And I said to him how important it's going to be for him. And he goes, okay, doc, what are you saying? What, 40 minutes, three times a week at a gym? I said, well, hey, if you can do that, that'd be amazing. So he goes away. And I see him in 4 weeks' time. And he comes back and I say, hey, you know, how are you getting on? He said, hey, doc, you know, I don't know, work's been busy. The gym's not on the way home. I'm not sure about how much it's going to cost in the gym. Yeah, I've not really done much.
Yeah.
Now, and I thought in that moment, I didn't think, why has he not done it? I just thought, you know what? Rangan, you're not giving him advice that is good enough. You're not giving him advice that feels relevant enough for him in the context of his own life. That's what I thought. It was probably quite an unusual thought, but that's kind of what I thought. So I thought, okay, right, forget this. I took my jacket off. I said, right, I'm going to teach you a workout right now that you can do in your kitchen that you don't need to join a gym. You don't need to buy anything. You don't need to even change your clothes. And, you know, it's something I call the 5-minute kitchen workout. And I literally showed him it in my practice. He goes away. He's doing it every day now. I only asked him to do it twice a week. I said, I just want you to do 5 minutes twice a week. Is that all, doc? Yeah, 5 minutes twice a week.
Yeah,
by making it simple and achievable. Every time he's in the kitchen now making his dinner, he's like, hey, you know what? I'm just going to knock out that 5-minute workout.
Yeah.
And the way I try and inspire my patients to make behavior change is by trying to tap into their lives and go, what's going to move the needle for them? And, you know, Tim, the reality is, that's sort of what I did on Doctor in the House, whether it was type 2 diabetes, whether it was someone with anxiety, you know, really bad panic and anxiety attacks, managed to reduce them by 70%. Whether it's an insomniac, whether it's someone with fibromyalgia pains, for 10 years, been under 5 specialists, again, pain-free in 6 weeks. I think it's because I had more time with them, I got to try and figure out what was going on. And so I think people can make behavior change, but I think we need to inspire them and individualize it.
Two of the best pieces of advice I like to give are, one, if you're going to go to the gym, only go for 20 minutes a time. Because if you only think you're going for 20 minutes, you'll be bothered. Like you're saying, the five minute. And the other one, sorry.
Can we see a bit of the 5-minute workout? Because we're in the kitchen.
What is the 5-minute workout?
Okay, the 5-minute kitchen workout, literally, right? And to be clear, I've got 20-year-old patients doing it. I've got 80-year-old patients doing it. So, okay, Tim, you've got to love the kitchen. So,
stand in front of the camera.
Yeah, okay, well, look, right. So what you would do, for example, is, like a press up, for example, is a great exercise. And not many people could do it on the floor, but what can you do if you're not that strong? You can go on your kitchen worktop and you can just knock out 5 press ups here, right? So the point is, if someone's not that strong in their kitchen, they've suddenly got a gym, right? You can then turn around and do some tricep dips. So you can just turn around. This is all fixed, isn't it? And you just knock out, you know, 5 to 10 tricep dips. You can do, you know, you can hold on and do some squats. Right? And this might sound wacky, right? But the reality is that this is the kind of stuff I do with my patients in my practice.
Yeah.
And I think they like it. They like the fact that
it's great. Yeah.
And and people say, is it your job? Shouldn't you refer them to a physical therapist? I'm like, no.
No.
They're in there. They may never come and see another doctor this year. I need to inspire them in this moment.
So the other piece of great advice I have, I snack like everybody else. I'm not a saint at all and I like eating all sorts of junk, but I read this once and it's brilliant advice, is about 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, when you've had your main meal, go upstairs or wherever you need to go and get ready for bed. By getting yourself sort of ready for bed by cleaning your teeth, doesn't mean you have to put your pajamas on, but by cleaning your teeth and washing your face, you then can't be bothered to go and snack again because you have to clean your teeth again.
Hey, you know what? I've heard that one. I like it.
It's really good because I do it when I take my daughter to bed, I clean my teeth then. And then you can't be bothered to snack. You just drink water and you don't snack. And it's really...
That's a great hack, Tim. I've not heard that.
It's a good psychological thing to stop snacking all the way through the night. I've finished my eating for the day. I've cleaned my teeth.
Yeah, well, I think that's fantastic. I mean, another good one, which again, feels extreme to some people, but I don't think it really needs to be, is I say control the environment you can control. And what I mean by that is, if you're trying to cut down on sugar or junk, whatever reason, and you've got it in the house, I think it's very, very challenging.
Say that. I chuck it out.
You've got to chuck it out. The reality is, once you step out the front door these days, right, you are challenged. Your willpower is constantly challenged. You want to fill up petrol for your car? You have to stand in line by all the chocolate bars as you're waiting to pay. You want to buy just a simple coffee now. What are you doing? You're waiting and you're walking past everything. Even if you manage to use your willpower and say no, what does the barista say? Oh, hi, sir, would you like a pan of chocolate? Yeah. So my point is, willpower is a finite resource. Uh-huh. Let's not use it up when we don't need to. So I say, this happened literally last week. I was watching telly in the evening, just trying to chill out. And I said to my wife, God, I feel like something sweet. Look around the house, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't feel like nuts at this time. I say, what happens you don't eat?
No, it's it.
Yeah, so I say, if you want to have your sweet treat, have it when you're out in a cafe with some friends, enjoy it, savor it for what it is, but don't use it to sort of, when you're bored in the evening and that's why I think we struggle with behavior change.
Yeah. So you've written a new book. Your first book, The Four Pillar Plan, was obviously a great success. How has it moved on then? How's The Four Pillar Plan moved on to The Stress Solution? Similar sort of ideas, but just...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I've got to say, I'm really proud of The Stress Solution. I think it's a real evolution from The Four Pillar Plan. The similarity is purely this. The similarity is that I want to simplify health. I want to break it down so people understand what the issues are and then give them really accessible, practical tips that they can do. I'm not interested at the moment, anyway, writing a book that's really deep in theory, and yet people go, yeah, that's interesting, but I can't do that in my own life. And so the similarity is that I've broken down, there are solutions in every chapter, simple solutions that actually often take 5 minutes or often take 10 minutes. And these are solutions that actually, I haven't just sort of fabricated in my head. This is from nearly 20 years of seeing patients. These are things that work in real life for busy people, you know, busy mums, busy dads, people working two jobs, people having to look after elderly parents. They're almost like hacks, if you will, of how you can, you know, fit little, stress management techniques into your daily life.
Okay. What I like about your books is you break it down. You make it easy to understand, like the four pillars. That's a great concept. What were your four pillars again? I've got
food, movement, sleep, and relaxation.
Right.
Okay. This is almost like the relaxation bit magnified in some ways.
So now you've broken this stress down into four solutions to stress, which is purpose, relationships, body, and mind.
Yeah. I've done it in order to try and simplify it. Not because people can't understand complex things, not at all, but I want, my goal with writing this, you mentioned that 100 million right at the start. Okay, my goal is I want every person, my dream would be that every person who buys it actually feels inspired enough to actually make a change in their lives immediately. That's my goal with it. And, you know, the people who've read it so far have all said, you know, as I'm reading, I think, God, I can do that. It's not going to take long. And so these four areas are what I call the stress superhighways that exist in 21st century life. And, you know, like, and they work both ways. So let's take relationships, for example, which is one of the pillars in the Stress Solution. You know, we're told at the moment that we're living these ultra connected lives, right? We've never been more connected than ever before. And certainly that's true in a digital sense. But in terms of real human meaningful connection, I'm not so sure. You know, what I see is a lot of isolation, a lot of loneliness. It's not just elderly people where isolation is sort of existing at the moment. You know, young males in society are some of the loneliest out there. And this is one of the reasons why the male suicide rate is on the rise. And so relationships as a pillar is like, you know, a lack of close relationships is a source of stress. But also if you're too stressed, that impacts your relationships. So all of these superhighways work both ways. Really trying to break it down, but then give a solution. So relationships pillar is something I'm really, really chuffed with that pillar, because I think I talk about lots of things that really need to be spoken about that probably aren't. So one of them is about friendship and how we need to nurture our friendship. So, you know, guys are really guilty of this. As we get busier in work and with mortgages and family, we start to, many of us, deprioritize our friendships. Not because we don't want to hang out with our friends, but we're too busy. And because we can sort of see what they're doing on social media these days, we can see on Facebook or Instagram where they've been on holiday, what their kids are doing, right? So I think we feel less of a need to see them in real life.
Yeah, definitely.
I've been guilty of this in the last few years. And literally in the last year and a half, I've really made this, you know, my closest group of mates are my uni mates. And, you know, we live hundreds of miles away.
Yeah.
And one lives in Edinburgh, one's in Bristol, one's in Kent, and I'm in Manchester. So we've figured out, like, twice a year, we're going to get together for a golf weekend. You know, we've always got to have a date in the diary. And even if I go into that weekend totally exhausted, physically, mentally, I come back refreshed. And it ain't about the golf. You know, the golf is the glue that gets us into the same place, but it's all about catching up, really. And it's a simple thing, but if people are lucky enough to live near their friends, I say it's not a luxury for good health, right? It's a necessity. I had a patient, right? A guy about 38 years old who I recently saw, he came in to see me. Successful guy, right? He's running his own business. He's working hard. Every weekend, he's doing his work emails, making good amounts of money. Comes to see me and says, "Hey, doc, you know, I don't know, just a bit low sometimes. I don't feel I'm as productive as I could be. Concentration goes a little bit. But sometimes, you know, I do sit there in the evenings and I'm feeling pretty down." And, you know, we did some blood tests because he was really worried about various things. Blood tests all came back clear. Spent a long time chatting to him, and I realized actually that all he does in his life is work, work, work. He never sees his mates. Now, for him, he's lucky. He lives in the place where he grew up, so all his mates are around. And I said to him, after I got to know him and we'd been through the blood results, I said, "Hey, look, I think a really good thing for you would be to spend a bit of time each week seeing your friends." He's like, "What do you mean?" I said, "Look, just give this a go for about 4 to 6 weeks. I want you to meet one or several of your friends every week. It can be just for 10 minutes or half an hour without your phones, so you're really present in that interaction." And I said, "I'll give you an appointment for 6 weeks. Anyway, to be fair to the guy, he went away and did it. He comes back in 6 weeks. I'm not kidding, like a different person. He's like, "Oh my God, I had no idea what impact that would have." And what would he do? Sometimes he'd go and play five-a-side. Sometimes on a Sunday morning, he'd just go and have a latte with them at the local cafe. But he was just chewing the fat with his mates.
Yeah.
And he comes back 6 weeks later. He says, "You know what? I'm sleeping better. I feel really good. I'm more productive at work. I'm not feeling low anymore." And, you know.
I have a little problem with the Netflix factor, which I think I've been started to talk about on the podcast now. Netflix is, and the dramas are so good.
It's so good.
But they're also becoming very addictive. And like my friends who used to talk about football constantly are now saying, "What drama are you watching? What are you watching on Netflix or Amazon Prime or whatever?" And I think they're taking over a lot of our lives. And I think people are coming home and going, "I'll watch a Netflix," rather than going out. And so again, they're living people's lives through, they're watching other people live their lives basically through drama and actually not getting out and doing it themselves.
Yeah. And you know, we're social animals.
I do it too, by the way.
Hey, I can do it.
I love a Netflix drama.
So do I. What are you watching at the moment?
Why am I watching? I'm just finishing off the Vietnam thing, the documentary, which is fantastic, but it's very long. It's like
I'm in the middle of the final season of House of Cards, which...
Oh, I sort of gave up.
Did you?
I gave up when Kevin Spacey...
Well, I thought I was going to, and literally about 10 days ago, I started watching the... I just thought, oh, you know, I think my wife was out, and the kids are in bed. I thought, I'm going to watch it. I thought, oh, this is good.
What'd you play off, by the way?
I haven't played for about 3 or 4 years, but I got down to 15.
Wow, that's all right. That's good.
And I wish I'd taken up early, really. But
Tim, can
I just say on that loneliness piece, because I think it's really important that people understand this, is that some studies have shown that being lonely is as harmful to your health as smoking 15 fags a day. Right? And I think that is really striking. And I think we're not taking this seriously enough. You know, we've thrived, we've evolved to have real life human connection. And that has been, it's insidiously being removed from society, whether it's by computers, whether it's social media, whether it's we don't see our mates anymore because we see what they're doing on social media or we're on Netflix. I love all those things as much as the next guy, but we've got to remember that we thrive off human connection. And the reason why loneliness is so harmful is you can measure, if someone gets socially rejected in a certain situation, 45 minutes later, you can measure that their genes have changed in their expression. They are more inflamed. So why could that be? That's because if you look at it on an evolutionary level, if we're left isolated and we're not part of the tribe, we are prone to being under attack. We are prone to being in danger. So our body adapts for that. So you'll get inflamed. Your immune system will ramp up in case you get attacked. You are better equipped to deal with that. And once you start looking at stress and loneliness through an evolutionary lens, and you think, well, this is how our stress response has evolved, yet the modern world now, we're no longer reacting to being out of the tribe. We're no longer reacting to sort of lions that might be attacking us. We're now reacting to many aspects of our daily, everyday lives. That's why we've got such a big problem.
We are moving so far away from nature.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And I always say on this podcast that work, you've got to think of it as a game and not real life. Because if it was real life, people would be punching their bosses and stuff, you know. It is a game. I think work is a game, and then that puts you under stress because you're involved in a game. You're not actually involved in real life, because it doesn't work out that way, does it? The survival of the fittest in the workplace doesn't happen.
It doesn't. Those mechanisms that served us so well are no longer serving us.
There must be a purpose for stress, because everyone says it's like it's a really bad thing, but obviously stress is there for a reason. So
absolutely.
So why is it there?
Stress is there to turn us into the best version of ourselves. You know, in a nutshell, stress is not all bad. A little bit of stress is absolutely what we need. You know, we need that to perform at our best. So, you know, to run away from a lion, right? If that's 2 million years ago, you know, a wild animal might be attacking and we need to get fight or flight ramped up. It helps us escape. How does it do that? All kinds of things happen in the body when we're feeling stressed. Sugar pours into your bloodstream, which makes you run faster. Brilliant. Your brain, your emotional brain, your amygdala will start to be on high alert. So you are hypervigilant for threats. Okay, and there's so many other things happen. If we just take those two things, in the short term, that is brilliant. But if you're getting stressed out every single day of the week for the whole day, right, and suddenly that sugar pouring into your bloodstream is going to cause energy problems. It's going to lead to weight gain. It's going to lead to high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes. We talk about your emotional brain being on high alert. Being hypervigilant when you literally are under attack is a good thing. If you're hypervigilant day in, day out, because, you know, you're stressed out at work, that's what we call anxiety.
Or you're in a car.
Exactly.
For some reason, cars make us stressed, don't they? I don't know why.
Again, it's artificial in some ways to be locked inside this box, isn't it? But it's about these mechanisms are there. The stress response is there to protect us.
So how many people do you think are in constant stress? 100% of people, or?
I won't say 100%. Less. Look, to be clear, it's not just me saying this. The World Health Organization say that stress is the health epidemic of the 21st century. They're not saying that about diet, lack of physical activity. They're saying that about stress, right? A study in 2013 in the Journal of the American Medical Association said that up to 80% of what a GP like me sees every single day in practice is in some way related to stress. 80%. And that is because, right, all kinds of symptoms, whether it's anxiety, poor memory, insomnia, inability to concentrate, gut problems like irritable bowel syndrome, low libido, all these things, in some way you can relate to stress. If you're running away from a lion, right, your body prioritizes what it needs to and switches off what it doesn't. It doesn't need libido then. It doesn't need you to be able to digest food. So how many people are coming to see me with gut problems that I actually manage to get better when I deal with their stress, and I can't get them better until I deal with their stress? It's the same with libido. And, you know, I think it is endemic, and I'm not saying that to scare people at all. I actually think it's not that hard to actually live in the modern world and have a few little hacks that you can put into your life that actually mean your stress level is going to be right down.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list here of things that are harmful for you for stress from your book. It's quite a long list, isn't it, of things that constant stress is going to give you problems, long-term and short-term.
Yeah, short-term and long-term. And the thing, Tim, I'd say there is that stress is kind of silent. You know, we're often so busy, we're so disconnected from our bodies now that often we're not even realizing when we're stressed. You know, it's easy to focus on your diet because we eat 3 times a day. You can see the food. Oh, you know what? This is a bit unhealthy. I should be eating healthier. Brilliant. But, you know, I had a patient, right, who's type 2 diabetes. And I only managed to put his type 2 diabetes into remission when I dealt with his stress levels. He was already eating a really good diet, right? But his blood sugar had come down, but it was locked and was stable. I couldn't get it any lower. And it was only when I started to address his stress levels that his sugar started going down. And even when we talk about type 2 diabetes, people talk about it as a dietary driven illness. I disagree. I think it's an environmentally driven illness. Food is one component, but so is insomnia, right? Insomnia contributes to type 2 diabetes. If there was this study done a few years ago, healthy adults, so these are not people with type 2 diabetes, healthy adults sleep deprived to about five and a half hours a night, for 6 days. Most of them, their blood sugar had gone up by 40%, and many of them were pre-diabetic just from sleep deprivation. And I can tell you the same thing about stress. So, you know, I get very passionate about this because
yeah, I can tell.
It's about we're so reductionist. We want to look at the one thing. And the reality is there are several factors going on in our modern lives that are impacting the way that we feel now today, but also whether we're going to get sick in the long term. And I think stress is one of those big ones that we're simply not talking about enough.
Sleep's such a huge one, isn't it? We did it with Mia Krieger, as I said earlier. Who's the British guy? He's on your website, isn't he? Matthew Walker.
Matthew Walker, yeah. I did a podcast with Matthew, a good friend now.
He's fantastic, isn't he, Matthew Walker?
Matthew's brilliant.
But the amount of disease they put down to lack of sleep, yet we're still told if we sleep more than 8 hours, 9 hours or something. I mean, I know it's between 7 and 9 hours we're supposed to have, but we're told we're lazy. It's like, no, actually, we need sleep. That's one of the most important things we need.
Yeah, and Tim, I think you've hit on that big societal pressure problem that we now have. You know, sleep is for wimps. Right, you know, you work through, you power through, you know. What about work? You know, you don't take a lunch break. You know what? You're powering through, you're doing your emails whilst also eating your lunch. That has a consequence.
Yeah.
Right? But you know, we don't celebrate like the French do, the people who just like, I'm knocking off work now, it's lunchtime, I'm gonna sit down, yeah, chill out, have my meal, have a glass of, you know, half glass of red wine. You know, there is something to be said for that. And you see it, you know, I don't live in London. I see it even more when I'm down in London, which is most weeks. You know, everyone's rushing around. Everyone's so busy. You know, we can't sit and enjoy a meal anymore without also doing something else. You can't even, you know, downtime, and this is something I talk about a lot about in the book, is that downtime has been eroded from society. So even something as simple as standing in line in your favorite coffee shop, right? I'm going to guess 10 years ago, if you were doing that, you might be daydreaming a bit. You might be looking around. You might be, you know, you might bump into someone who you know. Now, and I don't mean you, I mean any one of us, now often what's happening is that we're waiting in line, we're straight onto our phones, we're catching up, yeah, right? We're getting, you know, I'm getting ahead. You could have walked past your best mate, you wouldn't know because you both got your head stuck in your phones. And I think these sound like small things, but these are big things that, you know, if we're doing that day in, day out, year after year, there is a consequence for our health.
One of the things you've got here on the mind bit of your book is take a digital holiday. I'm determined to do that this Christmas. I don't know when this is going out. It's just post-Christmas, so I might have done it. I'm determined to take 2 weeks digital holiday. I don't know whether I can achieve it or not. I'm so addicted.
Yeah,
I'm so addicted to my
phone.
We're
all addicted. The question is just how much. You know what? Last year in February, my first book had come out. I never had a book out. I didn't know what was involved when a book is out.
Yeah.
Because it did so well, which I don't think it was expected to, I certainly wasn't expecting it to, there was just so much press, so much travel. I was burnt out. I was literally working myself into the ground. And I remember phoning my wife from London saying, look, the kids are on half term next week. I don't care where we go. I just need a holiday. And I put it all on my channels. I said, right, I'm off social media now for 9 days. And I remember getting to the hotel, and in the hotel safe, I put my phone and my laptop in it, and I shut it. I didn't look at it all week. And I've got to tell you, I had probably the best holiday of my entire life. Not because of where we were, but simply because I was present. I was able to interact with my kids all day without thinking, oh, you know, I better check what's going on Twitter, or I better see if I need to. It was, you know, again, things had got so bad, Tim, right, that forced me to make a change, which is what we were talking about before. You know,
yeah.
When does it get that bad where you just can't cope? Right, I'm going to make that sort of change. But I've already pre-planned that for February this year. We'll do the same thing. So I know, because I'm going around the country a lot in January at lots of speaking events, and I know I'm going to be burnt out.
A great saying is you should meditate for 10 minutes every day. Unless you're too busy, then meditate for an hour.
Yeah, I love
And I love that because I always think about that when I go, I'm too busy. I always go, don't do anything then, just relax. If I'm too busy, don't do anything, because it means my life's breaking now because I'm too busy.
But then, you know, that's probably a bit of life experience there that's taught me that, as it has with me. You know, you think in your 20s and your 30s, you can power through. And there comes a point you think, actually, I just don't feel good. There's just too much going on. And I found I have been trying to get a daily practice of meditation in for years. And I'd do it for a few days and then I'd fall off the wagon.
Yeah, I'm the same.
But I've got to say, the last 2 or 3 months, I finally managed to lock it in. Yeah.
The way I try and do it is walking.
Do you?
Yeah, so I try and go for a walk daily, and it's my form of meditation. Sometimes short, sometimes long, but that's the way I try and do it. Because I tried the meditation. I still try meditation, by the way. I noticed you've also got breathing exercises as well.
Breathing's the simplest way to de-stress. Our bodies are a reflection of how stressed we are. So, and breathing is a thing that changes immediately. So if you're stressed and anxious, your breathing will become shallow and fast. But we're so busy, we're not even aware that it's happening. And so I've got all kinds of breathing techniques that literally I found work. I mean, one I came up with a few years ago in practice called the 3-4-5 breath.
Yeah.
Which my patients love because it's dead easy to remember. You could do it anywhere. And the point is our nervous system, right, has got two broad branches. One is the kind of stress part and one is the relaxation part, or what I call the thrive part in my book. And you know, anytime your out breath is longer than your in breath, you start to activate the thrive part of your nervous system. So the 3-4-5 breath is simply, you know, you breathe in for 3, you hold for 4, and you breathe out for 5. You do that 4 or 5 times. It takes about a minute. You feel like a different person.
I'm just reading some books here. Seeing eye to eye looks a bit...
Seeing eye to eye is, I tell you, I mean, you need a bit of time to explain that. That was an exercise I did at an event and it really affected me. I thought, wow, I don't think I've ever done that with my wife before, let alone with a female stranger who I never met. So I do elaborate on that. But you know, that is all in that whole chapter on
relationships
and intimacy, and how, you know, it's slightly controversial, but I kind of feel that many of us these days are having... you know, extramarital affairs with our phones, in
right,
the sense that,
okay,
you know, we probably know the curvy contours of our phone arguably better than our partners, which, you know, I think on one level is a little bit worrying. But I think it's a cliche now that you might have a couple in bed together at night and, you know, yes, you're just feet away from each other. But if you're both on your devices, you literally could be off in complete different worlds. Everything's personalized. Everything's customized. Your whole feed is curated for what you want. And yet you are literally feet away, but you could be millions of miles away. And it's a bit of a cliche, but I think it's true.
Yeah. What's great about this book, by the way, is you've done, you know, the things like the mind and the body, but you've put it in a health aspect because you're a doctor. So there's some really practical things to do here to make your life better. All of these things I basically discussed on my podcast, but you've put it in one book and you've got good examples of ways of doing it and some actual exercises, haven't you?
Yeah, loads of them. And again, it's not about, it's a bit, again, the similar theme to my first book is this is not a prescription, right? Mm. If I've made a recommendation and you don't like it, don't do it.
Yeah.
Right? There are so many recommendations that I want people to go, the ones that, oh, yeah, I quite fancy that. I reckon I could do that. Start there. Don't make it difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I have made deals with patients before on meditation who say, oh, I can't do it, doc. And I say, well, first of all, I say, look, if I asked you to run a marathon now, would you be able to do it? So no, I'd have to train for it. So it's no different from meditation. If we've had our whole lives having a monkey mind, we're not suddenly going to hit a Zen state in 10 minutes. And I said, look, okay, what can you commit to every day? He said, oh, I don't know, doc, it's not for me. I say, all right, I'll tell you what, you brush your teeth for 2 minutes twice a day, I assume. You go, yeah. So what about 2 minutes? 2 minutes, is that all? I said, yeah, 2 minutes, as long as you can do it every day. I say, all right, yeah, I'm with you. And what they do, they start off doing 2 minutes a day. 2 minutes is achievable. It's like your 20 minutes in the gym, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to put you off.
No.
They keep doing 2 minutes each day. It starts to become a new habit. After a week or two, they're like, you know, 2 minutes has become 5 minutes. After 3 or 4 weeks, those 5 minutes have become 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's always my approach, is keep it easy, keep it simple, make it achievable in people's lives. I'm not interested, Tim, in giving people advice that might be brilliant advice that they don't do. It's not interesting in it. I've seen that in practice and I've changed the way I practice because I know that the majority of people I see can feel better than they currently do. And this ain't just about health. Genuinely, you know, I call my podcast Feel Better, Live More. The reason I call it that is because I genuinely think feeling good in yourself is a necessary ingredient to living your best life, to getting the most out of life. You know, whether it's your relationships, whether it's the things you want to do at the weekend, whether you want to be able to play with your kids and run around kicking a football, often we can't do those things because we feel crap.
So what do you think is the future of medicine then? Where should we go?
I'm a huge fan of lifestyle medicine, which, you know, is a slightly controversial term for some. And I don't think it needs to be. The point is, if 80% of what I see is in some way related to stress, why don't I look for lifestyle solutions for that rather than pharmaceutical solutions? I think the future of medicine is going to really be giving lifestyle the same priority that we give to drugs. And that is not happening. At the moment, you come in with type 2 diabetes, most doctors will spend 9 out of the 10 minutes talking about the drugs that are going to be used to manage the condition. As you're walking out the door, it'll be like, if you can lose a bit of weight and move a bit more, that's going to be helpful as well. I want to reverse that, where actually the first 9 minutes are spent, hey, would you like me to help you understand why you've got this condition and what I can help you personalize in your own life to help change that? When you have those conversations for 9 minutes, patients start to prioritize it because we prioritize it. If we prioritize pills, they're going to go out thinking, yeah, he told me to lose a bit of weight, but ultimately I've got these pills to manage it. And I have created, in 2018 with a colleague, I created a new course called Prescribing Lifestyle Medicine. In 2018, it was fully accredited by the Royal College of GPs. And it was the first course of its type that existed. We devised a new framework to deliver personalized lifestyle interventions within a 10-minute NHS consultation. We trained about 500 doctors in 2018. It's already sold out for January 2019. We're hoping to train maybe 700 or 1,000 doctors this year. And the feedback has been incredible because we haven't been taught this stuff at medical school. The stuff that is in my books, right? Whether it's the stress solution or the four-pillar plan, most of that I have learned from my own research, not from what I learned at medical school. You know, and I think the future of medicine is, it's not about saying it's either lifestyle or drugs. No, drugs can be superb and life-saving and really important, but we're overusing them for everything. We're giving antidepressants out like sweets these days. And, you know, there's many reasons
there's
for that.
There's a great stat I can't remember the stat now, but it was a great sort of a podcast I was listening to about medicine, about health the other day. And the doctor on it was saying that the amount of tests where the placebo gets fantastic results, proving that we're really good at curing ourselves.
Exactly. It's a real thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And the lady with fibromyalgia, right, who a lot of people talk to me about this case, she was on the second season of Doctor in the House on BBC One. It was like the fourth episode. She was on 20 pills a day.
Wow.
Right? She had 9 different diagnoses.
For what? What was her disease?
She had many.
Oh, right.
Underactive thyroid, anxiety, right. IBS, fibromyalgia. I can't even remember all of them. Yeah. Right? She had just been picking up diagnoses. And I stripped it all away. I said, look, let's just focus on you and get you working better. Right? 2 years on. Is it 2 years on? We're not even quite yet at 2 years. She's now on 0 pills a day and she's on no medication, right? That is, and most of that has been done. I was only with her for 6 weeks. I got her pain-free in 6 weeks, but I taught her the various factors in her life that will impact her health.
Right.
That's what excites me, Tim, as a doctor. 20 pills a day to 0 pills a day and symptom-free.
Can you reverse diabetes too in pretty much every case?
I don't think you can in every case. Right. I certainly think we can probably improve it in most cases. And in many cases, we can put it into remission now. And that is, you know, when I did that on 2015 on BBC One, that was controversial. Now it's becoming mainstream that actually we can do that. So, you know, I've come from a medical background. My family are doctors, right? I am very proud of being a doctor, but the health landscape of the UK has changed. When the bulk of what we now see are problems and conditions that are some way related to our collective modern lifestyles. Not everything, right? But many things. And I'm not putting blame on people. I get it's bloody hard for people these days. And you know, I think where you live, we've not talked about this today, but you know, if you live in a socially deprived area, your health outcomes are much worse. And that's something we do have to consider when we're giving public health messaging.
Yeah, I said on this podcast a few times, you know, what do they call them? Centaurians. What do they call them?
People who centenarians.
Centenarians never come from London or New York. It's too stressful.
Yeah.
They always come from the villages somewhere in Asia or something like that.
That's a really good point. You're absolutely right.
So, all right, listen, everyone who comes on this podcast asks the same questions. So you know what they are, don't you? So I'll ask them for you. Yeah,
you've had, trying to remember what they are.
I'll read them through again. What one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
You know what? I don't even remember you sending me this question now. So let's have a think about the one piece of advice is learn how to say no.
Oh.
Because that's the thing I
struggle with. In what, career or everything?
In anything, that
fourth beer.
I've been a people pleaser my whole life, and I'm only learning in the last 2 or 3 years, I'm learning the power of being able to say no and not thinking you're offending anyone.
That's really good. I said to my daughters, I don't care what you do in your life, absolutely not interested whether you want to drink loads, whether you're going to, as long as it's your decision and not somebody else's, say no. And I think that's the way to go through life. Try and be in control of your own thing and be your own destiny and be able to say no is a very good idea.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
That's really good.
And I think I say that because I struggle with it the most, but there is a power in being able to do that. Mm. Yeah.
What's the biggest mistake you've made?
Apart from not learning golf until I was 28, the biggest mistake is... I think it's probably that theme of that first one, which is I've said yes to everything. Right? I write checks that my body can't cash. So I think that's Top Gun, right?
I don't know. But it's helped you with your career because, you've ended up on telly and you've ended up doing something which is...
Yeah, you're right. So I think this is how things change in your life. So when you're trying to, get a platform to talk about your message, you sort of have to do that, or you think you have to do that. And I probably did have to do it, but I kind of feel now that's a behavior that has served me for 4 or 5 years. I'm not convinced that it's serving me anymore. So I guess it's about, can you adapt? Can you go, that was helpful to get me here. And now that I've got a platform, I feel I'm just burning out and I'm not spending enough time on myself. I feel often I'm too busy living other people's agendas and not my own. So I think it's about really focusing on what do I want out of life and what is going to help me do that.
Is golf the only sport you play?
No. Hey, golf is something I was into really late because I did my back in, which I've now thankfully fixed finally. But I used to be a racket sport player. Squash was a
squash.
Squash
really?
Is something I played a lot.
I imagine squash is not. You're so tall. How 6 foot, 6 and a half? Did
six,
you
say? 6 and a half? Yeah, exactly. But and squash, yes, a half is important.
Yes, it is. Is squash a good sport for such a tall man? I thought it was the one sport maybe shorter is better.
Tim, the old me would have said no, it's not a good sport because I always used to do my back in. But now that I've got to the root cause of it and I have fixed it, as it were, it's been a good 5-8 years now. I don't have back pain really. I can now play squash and I don't get any problems.
Squash players do their hips, don't they, as well?
Do their hips a lot, yeah, exactly. But also, recently I've started doing park run, which has changed my life.
Do your clubs have to be...
Yeah, they do.
Do you have to get longer clubs?
Yeah, so when I first started playing, because I'd done my back, and it was weird, a physio actually recommended golf to me. They said, I said, really? What about my back? And the physio said, no, look, the reason people do their back when they play golf is because they don't learn with the proper technique. And so he pointed me in the direction of an instructor. But again, this is another thing that this is another mistake I think I make commonly is I wait for perfection before I do something. So for the first 2 years, I never went on the golf course. I just had lessons in
You're
the range.
You're kidding me.
No, exactly. Complete obsessive.
That's mental.
Yeah, and then I realized that actually playing on the range and playing on the course, it's like two different sports.
Two different sports,
There's just very little crossover.
Yeah.
But I think there's, in terms of your question, there's a lesson in that in terms of perfection is often an obstacle to action. So so many people, think about, a lifestyle change. Someone's going to go, I want to get into running, but I don't have the right shoes, I don't have the right gear, I don't have the right heart rate monitor. Do you know what? None of it matters. Just put some shoes on and get going.
For a run,
Yeah. And I think, that's another thing I think I commonly make a mistake at is I wait for perfection before I actually do anything.
Any life hacks, maybe travel tips, how to give up something, how to clean something, any of these type of things?
Life hacks, I'd say, I'm a huge fan of morning routines. I think it's, in our stressed out culture that we live in, right? We've all got a personal stress threshold, right? And the more stress hits we get in the day, the closer we are to our threshold. So, and when we get to our threshold, that's when we start to become tense and we start to overreact, become angry and start to blow up at small things. So life is stressful. I can't change that for people. But if you start off your day with 10 minutes of calm, right, you are going to be walking out the door in the morning much further away from your stress threshold than you would have been if you'd been trying to do your emails, trying to rush around. So I think, 10-minute morning routine.
Every morning, cold shower, they're good for you. So Wim Hof says. Cold shower, 2 minutes of meditation at least, yeah?
I'd say 2 minutes, yeah.
2 minutes. Everyone That's can it. Do. Everyone listening to this can do 2 minutes every day. Can you recommend a book apart from your own?
Yeah, I think the book I'm going to say is The 4-Hour Work Week from Tim Ferriss.
Oh, yeah, it's good.
Yeah, and not because it's really not about working 4 hours a week. I think it's a really catchy title. What that book did is it's the first book that helped me understand that time is the most precious non-renewable commodity we've got.
Yeah.
And it really helped me reframe how I look at time. And so I'll always be eternally grateful to that book because of what it did.
That's great. And the final question, what's the meaning of life?
Oh, it's just a simple one there. The meaning I think the meaning of life is to find out who you really are. What's your meaning? What's your purpose? Because I think for most of us, for many of us, we're living someone else's life. We've become a mirror reflection of everything else we've seen throughout our whole lives, whether it's our childhood, whether it's our work lives. And actually, very few of us are actually looking for who we are. And that's a journey I've been on over the last 5 years since my dad died. And I've got to say, it's one of the most rewarding journeys I've been on, is understanding who I am. And it always reminds me of that Gandhi phrase. I think when your thoughts, your words and your actions are in harmony, that's true happiness. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm hopefully on my way to getting there.
So what's your purpose? Well, your purpose is to help 100 million people. Just a small purpose you've got in life.
Yeah,
help 100 million people.
So my purpose is to, everything I do, right, and what's to do with work, whether it's podcasts, books, seeing patients, writing blogs on my website, whatever it is, the goal is always the same, which is to inspire as many people as I possibly can to become the architects of their own health. And that is really the unifying goal in everything that I do. And it makes me happy.
That's a great idea. Take control of your own life. Rather than waiting for your local GP to do it yourself.
Yeah, and I think the word inspire is important because we think that's what I feel my job is as a doctor. When a patient comes in to see me, I want them walking out the door feeling inspired by that consultation to go, yeah, you know what? I can do this. I'm going to go and do that. And I take that really seriously. I'm not saying I manage to do it every time. I probably don't manage to do it every time, but I certainly try my best.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Rongan. If people want to follow you, where do they go to? They go to Twitter, your Dr.
Chatterjee UK on Twitter, and on Instagram and Facebook, it's just Dr. Chatterjee, which is DrChatterjee. The podcast is For Your Better Live More on all the usual places.
Okay, and the book is out, The Stress Solution's out when?
December the 27th.
Right, so by the time this goes out, it will be out a week. So go and buy it. That's it. Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me.
Tim, thanks for having me.
Come back.
I would love to come back.
We'll do it again. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
Cheers. Lovely guy, I thought, Mark, and thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. I enjoyed talking all about the NHS and stuff. I thought he's got...
I know why you like him.
Why?
Because he reckons you could look like you're in your late 30s.
Yeah, God. I thought he'd drunk. I thought he'd been at that wine. He did say, though, and this is quite a nice thing. He did say that, you know, he meets quite a lot of patients. And he said, I would do quite well. So, you know, looking after myself, Mark.
Yeah.
There you go. But I've always been one of those people. I don't know if you're similar, but I listen to news. Like, they'll say things like, don't eat too much salt. And I think, oh, I'm eating too much salt. Or they'll say, eat lots of fruit and vegetables, drink lots of water, don't drink too much alcohol, smoking's bad. And I think, oh, maybe I shouldn't do all those things. But I've always been obsessed with exercising, though. Mm. Always been obsessed with it. I love it. I've absolutely adore exercising. That's why it gets me down with my back and my knees and
what
stuff.
Back?
Have I not told you?
No.
I've had a back operation.
Oh, right.
His mission is to help 100 million people feel fantastic.
Well, he's done that on our podcast. That's who we hit, isn't it?
That's the audience. That's the audience. I do like that idea, though. I might do one of those very soon. My mission is to, and then just pick a number. Nice round 100 million. I think his theories are good. Very similar to Dr. Tamsin Lewis. It's all about prevention. It's all about studying what's... You know, actually, it's about taking control of your own life, isn't it? And I think that's what we've got to start doing.
I would say he's less supplemental and drug-heavy than Tamsin Lewis. I remember when you were working with Tamsin Lewis, you had about 40 pots of pills. And he's more... Why don't you just try some stretching and some meditation and see how it goes, maybe?
Yeah.
I think there's a difference. I think they're both sort of equally, you know.
They're mates. They know each other.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, they do the similar sort of thing. But I think it's all about helping yourself. I think that's what your health is all about, is actually helping yourself.
It's functional medicine, isn't it? It's what it's called. It's a version of functional medicine.
Yeah, and on this matter, I think we should quickly discuss the fact that we've had some initial results back from predict.
We're not saving this for a mailbag.
Clinical trial. No, let's just quickly go into a few bits of it, and then, well, all we can say at the moment is we've got our grasp back.
We have no idea what we're doing,
and we can't read them. So that's it. That's all we can tell you at the moment.
We can read them.
We just don't know what it means.
What it's telling us.
Though we will say that all of our, I think the reason why Tim Spector was doing it was to prove that everybody treats food differently, their bodies basically.
Yeah.
And
my God.
The difference in our grasp.
Just us two.
Yeah. Is quite dramatic. So he's proving his point. But we'll find out, and we will do it on a mailbag special, because we will find out exactly what it means, and then we'll report back. Anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. If you want to contact us, you can. Please do. You can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy, or you can contact us via email, dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. We look forward to seeing you very soon, but for the time being, peace and Lovejoy.
Bye. Happy New Year.